thought about anything else.
We don't want to know.
We're dedicated, yes.
To our favorite shows.
All my circuits.
Everybody loves Hypnotoad.
Scary Dog.
Larson and Blurnsville.
Futurama.
Good evening. You are listening to a Rattalism Broadcasting premiere podcast, TV Party Tonight. I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And tonight, our favorite show is Transformers, War for Cybertron. We are up to Chapter 2, This Be the Earthrise, which dropped on Netflix on December 30th. And, oh, look, they've already announced when Kingdom is popping up. It's going to be May 30th. Write that down, guys. And the guys that we're talking about. First, he's a man who knows his Transformers. He's my expert. We bring him on for all the Transformers shows. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Cole Marentette. How are you, sir?
I am doing well. How are you?
Oh, I can't complain. And joining us, here's a man who has decided he was going to insinuate himself into all the podcasts, every last one of them. If you've got one, he's coming on that one too. Ladies and gentlemen, my co-host for On Trial and Long Road to Ruin, and coming to all the podcasts near you, Sean Comer, you are not. How do you do, sir?
If you all aren't sick of me yet after the past 9 years, or 10 years, actually, wow, 10 full years, get ready for the year when I finally do something about that. Yeah, Cole is the guy. We have people on this network that we bring in when we need to talk about something very, very specific. I am the guy you bring in when you just need to review something and you just want the perspective when it comes to some things of... I like what I like, and I'm going to tell you why.
And that's fair. So real quick, Sean, just so I can get you caught up to where we are, and then we'll get into Earthrise. One, 50 words or less on your history with the Transformers. I know we talked about this a bit when we did The Long Road to Ruin on the movie trilogy, but how'd you come to Transformers, and then what did you think? First, how'd you come to Transformers when you're done with that? What did you think of the first part of this Siege, which came out July 30th?
Oh, like most people my age, I was sucked in by it back when the Reagan administration decided that the secret to kids' TV was regulation, less is more. And so I kind of came of age with the G1 Transformers and, of course, the animated movie. And then I really didn't watch or absorb much Transformers media right up until the Michael Bay movies, which I've seen most of them. I think I saw all but the one or two that preceded Bumblebee. And I have seen those. Yeah, because we reviewed those on Long Road to Ruin. And then came Bumblebee, which I loved, and I was aware that there were a ton of series that had received varying degrees of praise, but for the most part, pretty fairly rave reviews. But unlike Cole, you know, I don't have a vast library of the absolutely gorgeous toys that have come out since I was a kid. I've not read what I understand to be the mostly brilliant IDW comics. And to be honest, these two series were the first Transformers media that I'd really sat down and fully absorbed since Bumblebee. So this was a goddamn treat. I loved Siege. I thought that the voice acting was depressingly below par for what I was hoping for. But I thought it was fantastically paced. I thought it was a definitely more nuanced, thoughtful take, a lot more character rich than what I grew up on. And I finished up that cliffhanger for Siege, really looking forward to dive into Earthrise. And we'll get into why, but by and large, Earthrise absolutely did not disappoint.
All right, so the last thing that happened in Siege was what the storyline is, that Cybertron is dying, and the Autobots and Decepticons are warring over a dying planet. And in a last-ditch effort to try and revive the planet, it is believed, and then pursued after, the Autobots are searching for the Allspark. And I think, in contrast to that, the Decepticons, once learning of that plan, want the Allspark for themselves, but I think the intention is to use it as a weapon to wipe out the Autobots. In addition to which, there's a space bridge, which has been inoperative for an amount of time that the Autobots get working, and half the Autobots, after Optimus Prime throws the Allspark into the vastness of space via the space bridge, half the Autobots jump into the Ark spaceship and go after it, while the other half of the Autobots continue the fight on Cybertron. And that is where we pick up with Earthrise. Optimus Prime is wrestling with his guilt. He is struggling with what he felt was what he had to do to save the Allspark from the Decepticons, but now he's like, I can't stop until we find this thing. That is of the utmost importance. Meanwhile, as I said, the Autobots are still led by Alita One, are still committing rebel acts against the Decepticons. They're blowing up. This episode starts. First one starts with them infiltrating one of the camps, and as it turns out, they found a camp of imprisoned Decepticons, which we will find out they are being imprisoned because Megatron and Shockwave are using them to drain their life force in order to power a spaceship to go after Optimus Prime and the Ark and ultimately the Allspark. And that is where we start with Season 2, Episode 1. So, Cole, let me go to you first here. I actually have two questions for you. One, what did you think of this opening episode, and who is Double Dealer?
I was, had mixed feelings about Siege. As soon as Earthrise started, I was on board. I thought that the voice acting was a higher quality. That was an issue I had with the first season. I thought that the animation was just as good. And I really enjoyed the in-depth, as we'll get into later, interplay between some of the characters. As far as who Double Dealer is, Double Dealer is a character who has a long and storied past in various different media of being a mercenary, implied by his name. He's not on either side. He sort of plays the sides against each other, trying to make a profit for himself.
Well, he shows up at the end of Episode 1. Were you shocked to see him? Were you elated? Were you like, really, this guy? What was your thoughts on the presence of Double Dealer?
Well, I was kind of spoiled, because as Sean had mentioned, I'm a collector of the toys, and the toy line for Earthrise launched well before the animated series. They were going to launch them about the same time, but COVID delays and yada yada yada, there were issues. So the toys came out well before the series, and Double Dealer was one of the toys that they released, and so I said, oh, Double Dealer is going to be in there somewhere. That being said, I was very excited to see him, because I like seeing outside factions that aren't just heroic Autobots, villainous Decepticons, they has fight.
Sean, what did you think of Episode 1?
Absolutely loved it. Yeah, I loved it. I loved the fact that from the start, this season, almost the first thing that came to mind when the season started was, this is some Walking Dead shit. And for a change, I actually mean that in a good way. because you've got the Autobots that, kind of coming to a parting of the ways, where Prime and his crew are aboard the Ark, and then you've got Alita One and her troop who have stayed behind to hold the line on Cybertron. And then you've got this kind of maniacal, ruthless cannibalization scheme by Megatron that's going on. And not unlike Cole, I was sucked in straight from the very beginning that we didn't go just right back to Optimus, that we started with Alita and I got to give him credit, the absolutely fascinating Megatron. This was such a breath of fresh air from the really one-note robotic despot that I kind of grew up with.
The standout part of this episode for me was the interplay between Shockwave and Megatron regarding Project Nemesis. So Shockwave, I love Shockwave. He's probably like one of my favorite characters in the Transformers universe because he's so pragmatic. He's so science-driven. Mm-hmm. And he's like, listen, there's a sector here that isn't producing nearly enough energon. We might as well cannibalize it for the greater good. And then you have Megatron, who, you know, you're absolutely right about Megatron. Megatron is usually portrayed, and Cole, you can weigh in on this if you feel a little bit differently, given the vastness of where Megatron's been portrayed.
He's layered. He's reluctant. He actually feels twinges of remorse at what he has to do to his own people.
That's what I was getting at. Like, the portrayal of Megatron here is that he's conflicted. Like, normally he's, at least as far as I've seen, that was what I was getting to, he is portrayed as more like, you know, Cobra Commander, you know, just I am evil and I want power and give me all the things, and he smacks Starscream around a bit.
And here he just feels like he's on the right side of class warfare.
He feels like he doesn't want to have to kill other Decepticons, and he's trying to avoid it. And Shockwave's like, look, buddy, we don't have a lot of options here. You need to do the thing for the greater good. And he's like, I fought this fight for these people, and now I have to kill them, and I shouldn't make that decision lightly. And I was like, wow, for a kid's cartoon, that's pretty goddamn deep. What do you think, Cole?
Right?
Well, there's been a long and storied history of Megatron in recent years being portrayed as at least someone who started out as heroic. They get into this in this cartoon as well, where he started out as a laborer, and then he ended up in the arena fighting for the pleasure of the higher-ups. And then he and Optimus Prime, or Orion Pax at the time, sort of formed this revolution. And they take over and throw off the chains of their oppressors and then start to fight amongst themselves. And that's where Megatron ends up becoming more and more extreme. And I'm 100% for it. I think that giving the villain a more nuanced and balanced approach is only going to make the storytelling better. If you can identify with the bad guy, then, you know, you've got the audience in the palm of your hand.
Yeah, you're doing something right.
Yeah, this is written at a higher level than I think its intended audience. I feel like it is. I mean, it says Y7, but I feel like this is written for an adult audience. I'm not entirely sure little kids would be into this.
I've got some bigger picture opinions on that, but I'm actually going to save those for the end of the show.
Okay, that's fine. Episode 2. So, we're finally looking into what's going on with Optimus and his crew up on the Ark, because we spent, as Cole mentioned, almost the entirety of Episode 1 dealing with Alita and Megatron. Mm-hmm. So here we have Double Dealer and his crew going into the Ark, and they end up getting into it with Optimus Prime and his group and Bumblebee and whatnot. This I'm going to have to read. Aboard the Ark, Bumblebee is suddenly jolted awake in time to hear Double Dealer order the mercenaries to set course for Planet Char. Just as Bugbite checks on the captive crew, Bumblebee ambushes and strangles them with the restraining cuffs, eek, before using him as a shield. Thrust and exhaust open fire at Bumblebee as Double Dealer aims at him. Suddenly, the recently awoken Optimus Prime tells Bumblebee to desist, as the Autobots are outnumbered. On Char, Optimus tries to learn about his fate from Double Dealer as he leads the shackled Autobots toward a large helical structure. Double Dealer is nonchalant and only sees Prime's predicament as just another job. His interest is piqued, however, as soon as Prime mentions that he knows how to find the Allspark. This doesn't stop Double Dealer from sending the captives to the mysterious patron, the Quintesson Judge Desus. All right, Cole. we know about the Quintessons. They're the six-sided, the six-faced judges. They are the from the original 80s movie. But over the years, they came to be known as the creators of the Transformers and whatnot. And this particular bag of nuts is cutting off his own faces.
Yeah.
That was great.
That was that moment, I was stunned that they went there. Because they've never really... The Quintessons have always been a figure in the background ever since the first movie. But they've never really played with them all that much. The closest we ever got was in one of the anime series. There was a Quintesson character who was completely batshit insane. But they never really played with him having to deal with having five different brains in one body. And the way Decius deals with that is he just lops off the parts that aren't useful to him. And now he has consensus. Oh.
Yeah, that was pretty wicked. Just keeping on that moment there for a sec, Sean, you saw Decius cutting off his faces and whatnot. What did you think of that?
It's satisfyingly dark, and yet not so much so in a curious way that you're going to have that same kind of semi-traumatizing impact of seeing the G1 Transformers and the G1 Autobots and Decepticons all summarily killed off in rapid fashion in the movie. So much I can say about what is becoming a real trend in this revival of so many classic Halcyon children's series, but I like the fact that having a moment like that in a series like this, where as we said before, it's rated TV. I believe you said it was rated TV Y7. I wasn't really paying attention.
I believe so.
Yeah, this was a 7. This is giving 7-year-olds some credit for what they're going to be able to handle. And really, I can't... When you really think about the level of carnage we witnessed in the last two full team-up Avengers movies, I think it was the right call. And when you look at, the realities of death and loss that Pixar kind of confronts kids with in nearly every single fucking movie, I think it was good to kind of pull as few punches as possible without necessarily feeling like you're going over the top and being visceral for the sake of visceral.
So this episode more or less ends with, it starts with Decius having paid engaging Double Dealer to go out and get these Autobots. Doesn't quite know what he wants the Autobots for. That's half the problem with him cutting off his faces, is the other five faces and him are in some sort of disagreement over what they want the Autobots for. In any case, Double Dealer's like, you're going to pay me? And Decius says, nope. So Double Dealer and the crew. Negative GI. at which point Double Dealer's like, well then, fuck you too. And he saves the Autobots from Decius, and they all get out of there, and Optimus Prime and Double Dealer are like, oh, see you soon, and he's like, I'm sure we will. And that ends episode. So they're off in space again looking for the AllSpark. That is where we get to episode 3. But a really, really fun episode to say the least. I have to say this, and this has been common of a lot of TV I've watched lately. Slow start. Like, this doesn't really get cooking until about the third or fourth episode, when things start shifting into high gear. And I have said that now about a lot of series I've watched recently, where the first couple of episodes, as they're trying to establish things, move a little bit slowly, but then things start to pick up. All right, so episode 3. We're back to Alita 1. And the thing with Alita 1 and the Autobots and Jetfire, who has turned on the Decepticons, is they end up rescuing a bunch of captured Decepticons, and Jetfire's like, don't do this. You're going to lead the Decepticons right to us. Like, this is going to end badly. And Alita One has the sort of moment of clarity, moral clarity, that nope, captured peoples is captured peoples. Whatever was going to happen to them is probably bad, and they need to be saved. Come what may, she cannot leave these people locked up. And Jetfire, again, the more pragmatic of the two, is like, this is going to end in tears, and it's not worth it. What did you think of that? I thought that was an interesting kind of moral debate between Alita One and Jetfire.
It's always cool when you give characters that are on the same side conflict. I think that is one of the great strengths of this series, is they're not afraid to show cracks in the armor, where, you know, you've got Jetfire, who is giving himself over to the Autobot cause. He is committed treason against the Decepticons and has joined the Autobots, and yet he's still willing to say to their leader, I don't think this is the right course of action, and be that ruthless sort of almost Decepticon-y voice of reason. And then they have the strength of spirit to have Alita One disagree with him and say, no, you know, we've got to be the heroes, or else what are we fighting for?
That's one of the things I liked about Jetfire. He's this, in this series anyway, he's this intriguing kind of three-layer cake of genuine remorse for some of the things that he did as a Decepticon, I don't want to say resignation, but an acknowledgement that this is going to end badly for him when inevitably the Decepticons catch up to him to kind of deal out his reckoning. And also there's a sense of, you know, definitely being decisive in terms of knowing that this is what I have to do. This is what's really best, both in light of what I've done and in light of what's ahead. Just brilliant, and not something I expected at all from a Transformers series.
Well, one of the hallmarks of Jetfire, going back to G1, is that turncoat storyline. Back in G1, Jetfire and Starscream were best friends to start out with. Mm-hmm. And then Jetfire gets frozen in ice for however long, and when he comes back, he sees that Starscream has completely changed, and he switches sides to the Autobots. So I liked that they decided to play with that, while still keeping... While adding nuance. It's not just you're bad guys now. I'm still a good guy.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the thing is, I don't remember that turn in G1 being developed quite as finely.
Oh, no, it's one episode.
So, meanwhile on the arc, Wheeljack gives good and bad news to the rest of the Autobots. The good news is he's found the Allspark. They know exactly where it is. It's on the other side of the universe, presumably on Earth. The bad news is they can't get there. They're running low on gas. they're running low on energon, and they're never going to make it. They're not going to make it much further, let alone to the other side of the galaxy, to Earth. So they're like, we got to find somewhere to go in order to remedy that problem. And he finds a perpetually open space bridge in the Nebulon system that they can get to.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, they acknowledge that this is probably a Decepticon trap, but again, you're running out of gas, you have no other options, you're just going to have to deal with it. So they get their call, and lo and behold, what horror do they awaken? What terror do they bring upon them? One of my favorite Decepticons, just because of what it is. Ladies and gentlemen, fucking Scorponok makes an appearance. Oh. Holy cow.
And he was so cool. They did a really good job making Scorponok a credible threat to anyone that got in his way, which is one of the hallmarks of Scorponok.
They made him to scale. Like, you know, the toy was so much bigger than the average Transformer toy. Which refresh my memory, Cole. Was he a headmaster? Was the deal with Scorponok that he was like a city, a robot, and a scorpion? I can't remember.
Yes, Scorponok was one of the headmasters. He was directly opposed to Fortress Maximus, who was also known as Autobot City. Or no, Autobot said he was Metroplex. Anyway, he was directly opposed to one of the other Autobot Transformers that turned into a city.
Was it Omega Supreme?
No. Okay. It was Fortress Maximus.
Okay.
Who was the second Autobot city.
Gotcha.
He was, like you said, he was always much larger than the other Autobots and Decepticons, as is befitting the fact that he was a city. And he was always portrayed as far more powerful than any of the other characters. And they really brought that across in this series and made him as badass as he should have been.
Yeah, you know, we're always lamenting that, you know, 9 out of 10 times in Hollywood, they get a hold of a character that used to be cool and they just mess him up. And it's like, oh, why did you do that to so-and-so? Not in this case, man. Knocked it out of the park. Good job. They one of the things I really liked about this, Sean, is how much of a horror element. And I'm not really a horror guy, you know, notorious weenie, as Robert Winfrey calls me. But I love the horror element to this. I loved the fact that, you know, as Cole mentioned, Scorponok was so much more powerful, that he was a monster. You know, it was just great.
Yeah. Yeah, congratulations. You threw a horror movie in a horror movie into my war epic. Congrats.
So Prime and Bumblebee cross the space bridge and find themselves within the atmosphere of a planet resembling paradise. They detect no sentient life below and wonder what destroyed the many structures on the surface when they receive Wheeljack's distress call about Scorponok. As Wheeljack is being crushed, suddenly Omega Supreme appears behind Scorponok, ready to save the day, but Omega was really a hologram, like you do. Leaving an opening for Optimus Prime to arrive and punch the mechanical scorpion in the face using his... right in the mush.
Optimus punched the mechanical scorpion is not a sentence I expected to experience, but here we are.
Yep, 2021, everyone.
You did expect that from Transformers?
Well.
Come on now.
All right, so the Autobots manage to get behind a reinforced door away from the beast as it comes down upon them. Time is against them as the charges have been set and the raging Scorponok stands between them and their path to the Ark. Unbeknownst to the Autobots, however, the Nemesis, and what's the Nemesis, Cole?
The Nemesis is the Decepticon answer to the Ark. It is a massive purple ship, because of course it's purple, it's a Decepticon ship, that is designed to chase down and destroy the Ark.
So, just as Scorponok is about ready to crush the Autobots, or you know, the whole place is about to explode, because things can't get any worse, here comes Megatron ready to, as he likes to say, crush Prime with his bare hands. And we're on episode 4. Alright, so at the Nebulon space station, they are trying to repel a rampaging Scorponok, but not having much luck. To make matters worse, the Nemesis has arrived, and Optimus Prime finds himself in Scorponok's vice grip. It is Megatron, however, who frees Prime with a blast from his fusion cannon. And he does this because nobody gets to kill Prime but Megatron.
As you do.
At least he's consistent. Megatron, Starscream, Soundwave, and Refractor join the battle, giving Prime time to order the detonator charges be removed from the space station. Bumblebee protests they won't be able to pass through the space station, but Prime counters that at the moment they need to survive Scorponok and get back to the Ark. So there's a bit of a time passing. Bumblebee and RC awaken floating in zero gravity in the space station just as Wheeljack reactivates the gravity controls, sending them all crashing to the ground like you do. The Decepticons, Scorponok, and Optimus are nowhere to be found. Wheeljack informs the Autobots that they've been sealed inside the blast doors due to the massive explosion and struggles with freeing them because of the antiquated control system. While the Autobots wait, Bumblebee reassures Mirage that surely Prime still functions wherever he may be. Nearby, Prime reemerges from the rubble to find Megatron slumped against the wall. His upper torso... yeah, this I wanted to talk about. His upper torso impaled by a girder. So, Megatron saves Prime because Megatron wants to kill Prime himself. Optimus saves Megatron because he believes, somewhere deep down, that Megatron can be brought from the dark side back to the light. and that Megatron is a soul worth saving, that theirs is a battle of philosophies, and that ultimately Megatron is a good person and should not let him die.
We're not so different, you and I.
Not often you get the hero saying that.
I know, right?
It is amazing to me that, like, that they wrote this deep and inner conflict into Optimus Prime, especially regarding Megatron. You know, like, Megatron, they will fight to the death if they have to, but if there's an opportunity for Optimus Prime to save Megatron, Cole, he takes it. And it's like, wow, you have the patience and the morality of a fucking saint.
That's just Optimus Prime in a nutshell, though. I mean, he's all freedom is the right of all sentient beings. I can save anybody, and as we'll see going on, maybe that wasn't such a great idea.
Yeah, because Megatron's like, you think I'm a good person, but hear me out. I've been draining Autobots for Energon, and when I ran out of them, I started killing my own people to do it. Oh, and by the way, I've murdered Alita 1. What do you think of me now? And Prime, of course, Sean, loses his shit. Anybody regains composure and urges the formation of an alliance with Megatron, who would rather die than join him. Prime's idealism won't let Megatron die, like we said before, and he laments the endless war that has defined them both. He dislodges the girder from Megatron's chest and swears to work together to save the Allspark. Yeah, your thoughts on this eternal moral struggle between Megatron and Optimus, and I want to repeat something here. Megatron's like, you know, Optimus like, but you're good deep down, and Megatron's like, I'm really not though. I did XYZ things.
Number one, Prime is Robo Batman.
Yeah, wait. Good call two, there.
Number two, accordingly, he will never fail to punch the living bejesus out of his mechanical joker, but only to the extent that it's nothing thorough reconstructive surgery won't fix. That surgeon will be putting in overtime and will need years of counseling to possibly wash away and reconcile everything that he saw on that operating table, but he will not kill him. At the same time, this was the episode where I think a lot of times I started to get a little bit frustrated at how it felt like they were really kind of reducing Prime down to Saturday morning cartoon hero tropes and the most stale one-dimensional of them at that. But then I remembered that no matter how much nuance they try to add to this, no matter how much reasonable depth they try to give both him and his struggle with Megatron, at the end of the day, this is Transformers, and he still has to be Optimus Prime. He still has to be idealistic and merciful and optimistic to a fault in terms of seeing the very best even in his most nefarious, diabolical, ruthless rivals. And yeah, it's also why it was kind of refreshing when, yeah, you know, he absolutely lost his utter ever-loving shit, and not for the last time in this series. And you know, punched him a crater in Megatron's face. It was wonderful, and yeah, I especially loved it for the fact that you know Megatron knew absolutely all along what he was going to be able to push Prime to do, and that to a certain extent this was part of his end game, is push him to the places that he doesn't want to go to, because. And maybe I'm reading too much into it character-wise. That's where Megatron lives. That's home to him. He knows every nook and cranny of that kind of ruthless nature. and doing what he has to do, even the ugly things that no one else has the will to. But he knows that that's uncharted ground for Prime. He doesn't know what doing those things really means. And he doesn't necessarily have the capacity to rationalize it and compartmentalize it that Megatron does. So
so Cole. Elsewhere, Starscream awakens and unable to find Megatron. Stop me if you think you've heard this one before. Quickly declares himself the leader of the Decepticons.
Ah, Megatron is dead. I, Starscream, am the leader of the Decepticons.
I just picture Starscream kind of walking around Decepticon base and, like, you know, Megatron's taking a nap. He's like, he's dead. I'm the leader. I was taking a nap. What's wrong with you?
Let's just face it. Starscream was the utmost fan service of this series.
Oh, they, of all the nuance they put into this series, they looked at Starscream and said, no, we're keeping him how he is.
Oh, yeah. Starscream gonna Starscream, and that's that. That's all there is to it.
It's just so funny to me, you know? Like, hey, Megatron's out for 5 minutes. Great, I'm the new leader. Why don't you wait a minute? And he does that a lot, right? Like, and that's why I'm making the joke about it, Cole, but, like, every presentation of Starscream, he has tried to quickly insert himself as the leader, even when there really was absolutely no opportunity.
There was one series where he was not that guy. It was Transformers Armada. It was a Japanese series, and Starscream in that was, like, a conflicted, nearly heroic, dark hero figure. And that's the only one. Every other continuity, Starscream is that guy.
Yeah, I was gonna say, but aside from that, you know, we could just as easily link to the, I think it was like 15-17 minute video that Lindsay Ellis made many moons ago, just detailing every single time Starscream has been that guy, and there were more of them than I ever realized.
Oh yeah, every continuity, every version of Starscream is that guy. Except for one.
It's amazing. So there's a brief skirmish between Starscream, the Seekers, and the Autobots. However, Megatron and Optimus Prime show up, and, you know, at this point, Optimus Prime is, like, dragging Megatron along. Like, come on, you. Well, you'll make it. They start to work together, and Starscream mocks Megatron's weakness and criticizes the shaky alliance and makes his bid to replace Megatron as leader only, and stop me if you think you've heard this one before, to earn a fusion cannon blast to the chest.
Of course.
Yep. That's usually how that happens.
Because Starscream doesn't learn. As the Autobots and Decepticons prepare to leave, Scorponok returns and both leaders send their troops into the fray together. This was funny, Cole. Prime orders Wheeljack to patch up Megatron, and Wheeljack's what? But for why?
you're serious, huh? Really?
That's fun stuff. Prime attempts to control the giant scorpion by riding on his back and looping a rope around its head. He is stung in the back. Before there can be a second sting, Megatron saves Prime again, firing on Scorponok and sending him scuttling away. But now Megatron intends to make good on his promise to execute Prime for removing the Allspark from Cybertron. Prime accuses Megatron's judgment as being Quintesson-like, which gets Scorponok's attention. Scorponok explains that is actually the last Scorponok, and that its kind never rose up against the Quintessons like the Autobots and Decepticons did, costing it the lives of its family. Oh, Scorponok's a real boy. Scorponok now judges both...
World's smallest violin, Scorponok, playing just for you, buddy.
Scorponok now judges both the Autobots and Decepticons as being like Quintessons due to the sentencing each other to death with their endless wars. Megatron, resenting the comparison, or being stung by its words, lashes out at Scorponok, giving Wheeljack and Prime time to disable the gravity controls again, disorienting the Decepticons long enough to escape to the Ark. Prime orders the Ark to depart immediately, unwilling to kill Megatron even now. However, Starscream, back aboard the Nemesis, prepares to fire on the station. Oh, this was fantastic. Starscream. Hey, Megatron's back there. I understand. Fire anyway.
Yeah, good, good. Whatever.
It's the only shot we have. But there's all kinds of things we can do. No, 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 no. We've exhausted all our other options. We must fill up the station. Prepares to fire in the station and the Ark, disposing of both Prime and Megatron. As Ironhide prepares to engage the warp drive, Starscream fires. There's a great flash. Time passes. The Ark and its crew are intact. Ironhide issues a confusing status report to Prime. The warp drive was never activated, and the spacecraft hasn't actually moved. However, the view screen shows no station, no space bridge, no nemesis, nothing at all. And we get to the next one that can only be enjoyed while inebriated on acid.
Yup.
Oh, episode 5.
Episode 5, best enjoyed while high. So, Cole, I'm going to need some help here, because I knew who Galvatron was, as Megatron is having a fucking ill hallucination. And I guess the gimmick here is that Galvatron is, as we know from the cartoon, Megatron from the future, and he's back to kind of get Megatron back on track again. But what I really want to hear you talk about, because I didn't remember who this character was, or what he is, or what the point of all this was, but Prime has, like, Homer's fucking chili pepper moment. You guys know that reference. He eats a hot chili pepper and proceeds to have ill hallucinations. Optimus Prime has that moment with Skylynx, which seems to be half dinosaur, half airplane. What the hell, Cole?
Skylynx is a dinosaur, a spaceship, a lynx, and a launch base.
And he's also last of the red hot tabletop clockers. Go on.
It's complicated. This is a new look for Skylynx, though. Skylynx was always back in G1, which is the last time we really saw him. He was arrogant and full of himself, but he was a true Autobot through and through. He believed he was the best, and he was the only one who could do the things he did, but at the end of the day, he threw his chips in for the Autobot cause. Whereas this Skylynx is, no, I'm the best. That means I'm the leader. And he challenges Alpha Trion, who is one of the... my continuity alarm's going off. One of the lead figures in the Autobot history. And keeper of the Matrix. Skylynx says, I need the Matrix. Alpha Trion says, you're crazy. And sends him here, wherever here is.
The dead universe is what they call it.
The dead universe.
my son was almost the dead child as he came stampeding out of his room.
With all the subtlety of the Kool-Aid Man.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if you're going to do that next time, just yell out, oh, yeah, please. All right, so we get a lot of exposition here. As you said, Skylynx tried to challenge for the Matrix, and Alpha Trion noped him into the dead universe. And there, over a millennia, he has had this wrestling with his conscience, that, you know, and he has come to realize that he only seeks redemption for his past behavior and to be freed from the dead universe. He's done the Dennis Leary. He's like, I'm sorry, I fucked up. And, you know, and he's just like, I don't want power anymore. I just want to live. Help me do that, Prime. So he guides Prime through the dead universe, a realm where thought is power. Prime's inner turmoil. I just want to be at the table when they were coming up with this. Like, all right, we want you to write this Transformers cartoons for kids. Okay, but what if there's like a hippy-dippy dead universe? Like, what? It's only powered by thought.
Hear me out, Robo Buddha.
Now, I don't want to be that guy, but this isn't a wholly War for Cybertron idea. They've gone to the dead universe in the IDW comics, and it was very similar in construction to what it is here. It's a place outside of time and space where thoughts have power and hippy-dippy bullcrap. So,
well, I mean, there's a difference between know, pointing something like that out for perspective and going the route of your average Twilight fan who would face with criticism of something just says, well, did you read the books?
Fair. Fair.
Was I the only one who did the reading?
No, and I appreciate you pointing that out. I'll take it to the IDW writers and editors going, were you all high when you came up with this? Because
the answer is yes.
Very.
You're writing funny books for children here. Like, but what? Yeah, but hear me out on this. Space Buddha. All right.
Okay.
We're the same people who like to who write the G.I. Joe crossing over with Josie and the Pussycats or whatever the shit was. But sure, whatever you guys want, whatever sells books. Prime's inner turmoil manifests as painful memories to his pledge to Alpha Trion to protect Cybertron with Megatron and Ultra Magnus. Skylinks accompanies the angst-ridden Prime as he reflects on the death and destruction of so many on his homeworld. He confronts a deep fear that Alita and all his Autobots will die on Cybertron under the tyrannical rule of Megatron, and Cybertron itself will be destroyed due to his removal of the Allspark. Look, I'm not saying I didn't enjoy this episode. I really did. But this is some heady shit, Sean.
Oh, it really, really, really was. And, you know, almost any other episode, I would have looked at this and kind of rolled my eyes and lamented that it was your standard garden variety exposition dump. And I'm not going to say that it entirely wasn't. But I like the fact that they brought in some pretty formidable legacy Transformers. So some very, very memorable ones for what I agree with what Cole said earlier when he and I were chatting privately are probably just going to be kind of one-off cameos. But they were one-off cameos that carried some weight in terms of what they were able to convey, and really helping to flesh out what has kind of only been alluded to in kind of brief, bitter, or remorseful, just kind of asides in mid-conversation between characters. And that's just the question of the fuck happened prior to where we came into this story? Because we hadn't really gotten very many answers up to this point. And here, we finally did. And we were able to pair that with kind of the fun of, well, shit, that's Skylinx Galvatron, and holy fuck, it's Unicron. To be perfectly honest with you, my only complaint about it is the fact that, for the most part, throughout this series, I've been pretty happy with how the Autobots have been voiced. Damn sure a lot more so than most of the Decepticons. But holy fuck, Alpha Trion was the most corny G1 sounding voice. So of the entire two parts so far, just it was bad.
So the way they get out of the dead universe is Optimus Prime uses the Matrix. He pulls the Matrix. It opens up a gateway. They're out of there. Meanwhile, as I was mentioning before, we have Megatron and his trip out experience. Aboard the Nemesis, Starscream awakens to see a portal just ahead of him in space. Before he can figure out what it means, Megatron arrives on the bridge. Hey, guess what, Starscream? Megatron's not dead, you dope. Ready to pay Starscream back for his treachery, knocking him flat with one punch. Starscream. After kicking Starscream off the bridge, Megatron orders Barricade to take the Nemesis into the rift to pursue Prime. Within the rift, the Nemesis is subjected to stresses and mysterious light, sending Megatron crashing to the ground. As he recovers, dun-da-dun, Galvatron appears. And as we all know, and even this one I can do, when Megatron and Optimus Prime fought in the movie, Prime did die, but Megatron was nearly dead. And the Decepticons got on board Astro Train, and there was too much weight, and as Astrotrain most famously says, jettison some weight, I'm never going to make it to Cybertron. And so Starscream, being the pragmatic Decepticon that he is, is like, well, let's take a vote. If you're healthy enough to be in this vote, say I. If you're not, we'll throw you off the ship. How's that sound? And so he threw off Megatron and a couple of Insecticons, and my memory fails me here. I know it was a few of the Insecticons. Did any of the Seekers get thrown off, too?
I think it was either Thundercracker or Skywarp. Okay. But there were some Seekers that got 86, too.
Right. And so Unicron shows up and says, and offers him he makes him an offer he can't refuse. He says, I have a problem. My problem is Optimus Prime and the Matrix. So how about this? I remake you into an even more powerful Decepticon. I'll remake the rest of these guys so that they'll follow you and not want to betray you every 5 minutes like your other guy does. And you go get that Matrix for me. It's currently in the possession of Ultra Magnus. Go. And so that's Galvatron. Has Galvatron been portrayed in any other way other than future Megatron, Cole?
Not really.
Didn't he pop up in one of the Bay movies?
He did. In that version, he was also a reformatted version of Megatron.
Oh, okay.
He was rebuilt and given life by humans and... Look, yeah. It was a Bay movie. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, now that you mention it, he's in Age of Extinction as the Megatron they think they can control.
Yeah. It is notoriously difficult to remember what happens in each of those movies.
No, it isn't. All you have to know is Devastator has big balls. He has the biggest balls of all.
That's true.
And Optimus Prime rode a dinosaur. That's it. That's all you need to know about those movies. much like the bit with Unicron there in this iteration, Galvatron tells Megatron, hey, it's really important that you get the Matrix. That's the key to victory. So on the Nemesis, Megatron and the guide see the Ark only moments away from exiting the dead universe. The guide tells Megatron to channel his hate and rage, and soon he is brimming with crimson coruscating energy, unleashing it as a powerful beam towards the Ark. However, Skylink soars between the beam and the Ark, taking the full brunt of the beam as he implores Prime to escape. Skylink is atomized, but the Ark makes it through the rift. So, see, Skylink is redeemed with his sacrifice. The guide tries to get Megatron to pursue them, and they are stopped as he intervenes, summoning the guide painfully back from where he came. The guide attempts to give Megatron something that might help him to vanquish Prime, but it quickly dissipates, and the guide vanishes, like you do. The Nemesis pursues the Ark through the rift, but the spacecraft find themselves in orbit over a watery blue world. It's Earth! We finally get to Earth in the Earthrise show. Right? I want to just briefly talk about that. So when they named this chapter Earthrise, was I the only one, Cole, who thought maybe they'd be on Earth?
You know, the thought had crossed my mind.
Mine too.
I thought that maybe in a show called Earthrise we'd see Earth, but, we do, so technically we're not wrong.
Sure. yeah, this was a weird one. I was reading some of the reviews before we started tonight, and someone felt, Sean, that this reads like The Empire Strikes Back. It's very middle chaptery. And it's a bizarre choice that they called it Earthrise, and they don't actually get to Earth until the very last moments of Episode 6.
Yeah, it's more like Transformers War for Cybertron. Oh, looky there, Earth.
but it definitely does feel very middle chaptery. A lot happens here, but it definitely feels like, we're not even close, and obviously we're not even close to concluding this thing, and I don't feel like a lot of headway got... Like, stuff happens, but nothing that really moved the plot along. The whole thing was we got to find the Allspark, and they find it at the end. Mm-hmm. So, back on Cybertron, Alita 1 is still leading charges against the Decepticons, and I'll just kind of fast forward to the end of this, Cole. They end up getting captured, and ultimately... I guess it's a question mark. We really don't know. Weirder things have happened in fiction. But presumably, Alita 1 and the rest of her team got blowed up in the Decepticon base.
Yeah, I mean, they really went a very Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid ending with Alita One's team, where it's like, this is it. That's the end of that team. At least it would seem that way.
And it's pretty jarring that we can say that in a Transformer series, that we really can't put permadeath past them.
It is certainly within the realm of possibility that they've, you know, wiped out that group of characters. I was surprised. I'm not surprised, as you're saying, Sean, I'm not surprised they killed characters, because they've done that in the past. I mean, that's how they got the new toy line out there, if you want to be cynical about it. But just narrative-wise, I was a little shocked in the kids' cartoon that they were like, well, you know, that was a really good way of putting it, Cole. You know, very Butch Dance and the Sundance Kid. It was just kind of the last ride of the Autobots. And I don't see how they got out of it. The way that she was still strapped to the gurney when the place went up, right?
Yeah, as far as we know.
Okay. So that's that. Did you have any other thoughts on that group, that particular part of the narrative, you know, the way they use the characters at all, Cole?
I thought that the inclusion of Galvatron was very interesting. And that one actually took me by surprise, because there wasn't a Galvatron toy in the toy line, which you can't say about any of the other characters. They even made a Quintesson toy. Yeah. But Galvatron showing up, I was taken aback, and that ties in with the Dead Universe and yada yada yada. In the comics, in the IDW comics, Galvatron is separate from Megatron. They are two distinct characters. Galvatron is an ancient Transformer that gets trapped in the Dead Universe for years, and Megatron is Megatron. So there you go. There's a difference.
Huh. All right, so moving on here, we find ourselves with the Autobots fighting the Decepticons out in space. Megatron and a team of Decepticons storm the bridge of the Ark and find it empty. Starscream calls the Autobots cowards before they leap out from hiding, because Starscream is a schmuck, ambushing the invaders. The Autobots gain the upper hand against the Decepticons as Megatron searches for Prime elsewhere on the ship. Prime, horrified by the Matrix-induced visions he received in the Dead Universe, unleashes a ferocious attack on Megatron, gaining resolve to end his life in order to save billions in the future. So, hell, that's a bit of an arc for Prime. Megatron mocks his honor, but Prime's resolve will not shatter, and he demands forgiveness from Megatron for the loss of the Allspark. At that moment, Cog encounters the two leaders and is horrified by Prime's decision to kill Megatron. This gives Megatron an opportunity to counterattack Prime while they are locked in the struggle. An explosion occurs just behind Cog, who is helplessly sucked into space.
Now, here I have an issue.
Okay.
Why is there atmosphere on a Transformers ship?
Good point.
Really think about that point for a second. They're damn robots. You're telling me they need to breathe?
That's a really good... You would think if anything could survive in the vacuum of space,
it would be a robot?
Yeah.
I feel like, didn't we've done this before in other elements of fiction where the robot went into space and it was just fine? A little cold, a little chilly. That was about
Futurama. It. Futurama?
Yeah, that's one. I can name a few others. I feel like I saw it in Star Trek. Yeah, Data did it. Data was like walking. I think as long as Data was magnetized to the ship, he was able to walk along with no other accoutrements.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I don't know. These particular Transformers, they're like what's his face from the Star Wars movie. You know, all robot except for the beating heart. The beating heart, Cole. No? All right. The culprits behind the explosion are the mercenaries piloting the Fool's Fortune through the rift in the Dead Universe. Ostensibly, they have come to honor their agreement with Megatron. These fucking guys. On the bridge of the Ark, Starscream is impatient as he asks Double Dealer for assistance, but the latter's tone has changed. He plans to destroy both the Autobots and the Decepticons. You can never trust the guy named Double Dealer, Cole. Never.
I know, right? It's right in his name. You'd think that they would figure this out.
and begins firing at the Ark. Starscream and Mumbly hastily form an alliance to fight back, but the Fortune soon further disables the Ark. The Fortune's not without its own troubles, however. Exhaust and Bugbite are patching up a hole on the craft, making plans for the future, when an unexpected assailant, Cog, fires on them both, sending them careening into space. Mm-hmm. On the bridge of the Ark, Hound redirects all available energy to shielding as a tentative defense against the Fortune. Double Dealer hails them again, hellbent on revenge. His actions don't make sense to Bumblebee. Why would Double Dealer knowingly try to kill Autobots as well as Decepticons, given he has a deal with the latter? But all becomes clear. As Double Dealer is revealed to be mind-controlled by Decius. Hey, he's back! He's
dun,
back!
Dun, dun.
The true villain of this thing, crazy-ass Decius. The Quintesson receives a surprise himself as the Nemesis begins firing on the Fortune. This is no act of Decepticon support. The Decepticons were invading the Ark. Wheeljack stole aboard the Nemesis and led a team to take control over its bridge. His plans were this was funny. So, Decius has control over Double Dealer. And he's like, I'll kill you all. And then his plans are disrupted. He is utterly defeated. And it's like, it's not even like a really satisfying defeat, Sean. He just sort of slinks off like, oh, all right. Like, it was so funny the way they animated him in that one scene. Like, he just sort of slinks off screen like, all right, you got me. Put the cuffs on. And then we never see him again. So weird.
I got nothing. Because, yeah, I too sat there watching that going, so that happened? what happened now? What he do?
Like,
what do he do?
I feel like we're missing a scene where he goes back to his office and, like, erases the dry marker board. Like, I have to come up with a new plan.
Put on the coffee, boys. We're not licked yet.
Okay, so he slinks away. Wheeljack keeps firing on the Fortune, jostling Cog and giving, moving on. Prime and Megatron bicker about which of them will possess the Allspark, but Prime turns words into actions and begins pummeling his adversary. Megatron soon begs Prime for mercy, but the request was a feint, as you do. Megatron shocks Prime with a nearby electrical cable. Megatron opens the chest cavity of the stunned Prime and extracts the Matrix. Oh no! Megatron has the Matrix.
He has the MacGuffin.
Fetch quest completed. Did I use that term right, Sean?
Absolutely right.
Outstanding. I could be a gamer. Optimus awakens.
I feel mocked.
You? Me? Never. Optimus awakens, but Megatron no longer refers to him as Optimus Prime, but rather Orion Pax. As Cole mentioned earlier in the show, that was his birth name before he became Optimus Prime.
Right.
Clutching the Matrix, Megatron fulfills the counsel recently given to him by his guide of the future. And as he raises his fusion cannon to slay Prime, Bumblebee comes to the rescue. Oh, Bumblebee.
The ugly one.
Little scrapper.
Yellow is sporty.
The little scrapper turned hero. That's the arc. Megatron escapes with the Matrix as Bumblebee helps Prime to his feet. The two Autobots limp to the bridge to stop Megatron from retrieving the Allspark on the planet below. Wheeljack and the other Autobots on the bridge have only bad news to report. The Nemesis is disengaging from the Ark, beginning to tear it apart, while the Fortune careens towards both spacecraft. Prime orders the shields to be raised as the Fortune explodes, sending debris plummeting as meteoric streaks in Earth's atmosphere. And then we have some time passing, and on the surface of prehistoric Earth, a Velociraptor... because all dinosaurs are velociraptors. Thanks, Jurassic Park. Stalks through a jungle. It pauses, its optic sensors detecting something unusual. A crashed spacecraft. The Ark!
It's Dinobot! I marked out for this hard.
Same.
All right, Sean, and then Cole, and then we'll get out of here. This wraps up Earthrise. This last episode and the series itself so far. What do you think?
A little bit of wonky pacing just after the middle, especially episode 5. While I really enjoyed it, it seriously did just grind things to a halt right before the finale. And that was a problem that I didn't feel like Siege had. Say what you will about the rest of Siege. Like I said, that was Cole Nightingale, the voice acting especially. But it was paced damn near letter perfect. But yeah, as you said, this is very much an Empire Strikes Back chapter, and I mean that in the best way. This is setting up Kingdom beautifully. And one of the things that I like most about the entire series so far, and as I said, I told you I'd have more to say about this, is that it's kind of the latest in this long line of continuations of favorite properties that kind of saw their glory days back when myself and Cole and to a lesser extent Mark were kind of an age when they were geared toward us. And it's where they took concepts that in the 80s were generated to peddle toys, to sell overpriced pieces of plastic. And I'm talking about everything kind of from this series going back and including, She-Ra, Voltron, Carmen Sandiego, all the way back to even the tragically underappreciated Thundercats reboot. And it's the idea that for the most part, it's taking these properties and saying, okay, these were cool, memorable, well-ingrained characters, neat, iconic visuals, full of really satisfying action. But maybe we can do a little bit more with it. Not necessarily that this stuff was bad, but I feel like this is a good thing and something we can take and meld into something great. And, I would even throw another one in there because it's the most obvious one, and that's My Little Pony. It brought some brains to the storytelling, a little bit of character investment. It doesn't feel quite so much like it's kind of pandering or patronizing or insulting the intelligence of younger audiences. It's something that kind of acknowledges that in the intervening years, kids have been exposed to more and more mature and layered and well-developed stories. And it's kind of giving them the benefit of the doubt with the idea of you can have characters that have some inner conflict, that aren't stark black and white, but are shades of gray. But it's also not above its fan service either. Like I said, the brief moments of, hey, kids, it's Unicron, Galvatron, and Skylynx. Throughout the entire series, Starscream's still going to Starscream. Because you still got to have that element of the classic property that is dependable, that's refreshing. It's that moment when you're walking through Tokyo and you can't read the signs and you don't recognize any food you see, but then you see a McDonald's, and all of a sudden you're right at home again. And all in all, what it adds up to is a series that is taking the best parts of, I think, all of the properties so far and telling what has the potential to be a really well-remembered story. And yeah, this was maybe a little shorter on the action than Siege was at times, just at times, but goddamn, I'm on board for Kingdom this May.
Real quick, I've enjoyed the series so far. I think I've been shocked by the level of writing for a children's show, and I'm pleasantly surprised. But it's put me in a position of I don't want to watch this with my kids, which is a weird thing to say about a children's show. I just neither one of them is going to get it, and I don't. It feels like
I think from what you've posted online, I think Lily could probably handle it.
Yeah, if she's interested. It's hard to say if she would be. If I tell them maybe they're all Japanese robots, then, maybe. that's how I got her to watch The Karate Kid 2 last night. I was like, they go to Japan, sit and watch. And she's like, hot dog.
Oh God, you're raising weebs.
Yeah. Oh, Sean, we'll talk later. but yeah, you know, she's 10, and I think like if she can find an interest level in it, I think it's good for her. It's not for younger than that. Eh. What I was getting to was this feels like a passion project for old Transformers fans. It reads that way, it feels that way, and I'm okay with that, despite the Y7 rating. The story has been interesting so far, not what I expected. It zigged when I thought it was going to zag, but I'm okay with that too. I don't, you know, if my expectations are subverted and the outcome is still positive, then I'm still on board as a fan. And with that, Cole, you have the last word, my love. Go.
What I came out of Earthrise thinking was that Netflix has really, they've taken what was, I thought, a rocky start in Siege, and they've crafted something loving. There is a level of appreciation of the lore and of love for this source material that is truly apparent in the interactions between the characters and the characterization. Do I have my issues with it? Yes. Optimus Prime has a mean case of angry guy voice for the last half of the series. but at the end of the day, I'm happy that Earthrise exists. I'm happy that we got a chance to see the nuance of the universe, and it got brought to a wider audience. Transformers has always been a popular brand, but a niche brand. And the fact that these series are on Netflix and they're heavily advertised and they're lauded by several critics means that we're going to have more people interested in Transformers as a brand. And that's a win for me as a fan.
And ultimately, more Transformers crossing over with weird properties.
Right? Incidentally, speaking of which, I did pick up the first two issues of Transformers Back to the Future. I was not on board at first, but I decided to jump on, and oh boy, do I have feelings.
Well, we welcome you to share those feelings in a few weeks when we talk about the entire iteration of Back to the Future Transformers with Jesse Starcher. With that said, that brings us to the conclusion of our review of Transformers War for Cybertron Earthrise. They have announced, apparently, according to the Wikipedia page, that Kingdom will be released on May 30th, so we'll bring you that review sometime in June. Hint, hint, we'll talk about it after the podcast. Every time I've done that today, I've actually put my hand up to my face. No one can see me do that. I don't know why I do it. Sean, what do you got going on in your world? I know you're going to be on a couple of other shows. I joked about that earlier. We've got you for Sabrina, and I can't remember the third one.
You've got me for Sabrina. I am going to be talking about the third season of Cobra Kai, and oh, damn, do I have thoughts on that. Thoughts that were not very popular with a couple of people in the Facebook group. And I believe either immediately after or before we talk about Cobra Kai, I'm also going to be joining you on Long Road to Ruin to talk about the Jackie Chan Jaden Smith remake.
On trial.
On trial, yeah. Of The Karate Kid, which I'm looking forward to because I've never sat down and watched the entire thing. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter at Comer Codex for updates on any future projects. I had planned on getting back to streaming tomorrow night, but as it happens, the lovely future Mrs. Comer has started a new job. That's the good news, but that also means that I got to adjust my schedule a bit around the fact that she is working two early mornings this week, and I normally stream fairly late at night. So we got to kind of figure something out that's not going to result in her being kept up when she's got to be at work in 8 hours or so. So I will just say, yeah, just follow me on Twitter, and I will keep you posted there.
All right, Cole, what do you got going on in your world?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at the Film Twit. You can find me on Instagram at Twitty Cent. because the film to it was taken, probably by me.
Yeah, by you.
And you can find me on Twitch at the Film Twit. I do stream weekly, Mondays and Tuesdays most likely, and then whenever the whims take me after that. And then my Instagram and Twitter accounts are primarily for Weekly Comics Roundup, which is my review of the new comics that week.
All right, you can find the first part, Cole and I talking about the first part of the War for Cybertron in the WTM network. Wherever you download your podcast, wherever you found this one, if you go back in the archives about 5 months, you'll find me and Cole spending a bit of time talking about Siege. In addition to which, myself and Chris Bailey reviewed AEW New Year's Smash. We reviewed both nights of that. That's up in the archives now. Earlier this week, we got into The Boys. First, myself and Christian talked about The Boys Volume 2, Get Some, Issues 7 through 14. And then myself, Jesse Starcher, and Robert Winfrey talked about The Boys Season 2. This Sunday night, myself and Pat Mullen will be doing another chapter of our History of Boxing podcast. We'll be looking at the wrecking machine that was George Foreman. And then, as Sean mentioned before, we've got a lot of podcasts next week. First, we start off with Star Wars Bounty Hunters, Galaxy's Most Dangerous, or something like that. Whatever the volume one of the trade is of Bounty Hunters by Ethan Sachs. That'll be me and Sheehan. The next night, myself, Alexis Haina, Dave Wright, and Andrew Graham will be talking about The Mandalorian Season 2. Just give Rosario Dawson an Emmy. Just give it to her. just hand it to her right there. Sean mentioned the On Trial for the Karate Kid 2010 with Jackie Chan and Jaden Smith. And then we finally end that week with our review of Cobra Kai Season 3. For Cole Marantet and Sean Comer, we thank you for listening to us tonight. Be well, be safe, and behave.
Bye. Bye-bye.